So thanks everyone for joining us for episode 5 of the podcast, which is called Finding Your North. And today I'm talking to Ellen Brewster, who was actually my neighbour in Oxford for a year. But I thought Ellen would be a wonderful person to talk about the kind of topics we've been sharing on Instagram about career and finding your direction. So I just want to welcome Ellen onto the podcast.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I feel like we're talking like we don't know each other, but we know each other very well.
Yes, definitely.
But actually, it's a nice opportunity to get to know about your work, like within your department, because I talked to you about that briefly, but not. So I just wondered if you wanted to introduce yourself and like tell people what you studied, your college, like when you were at Oxford, where you were for undergrad, what you're up to now, just monologue for us.
Yeah, sure. So hi, I'm Ellen, and I have just finished a PhD in 18th century English literature. I did my undergrad at Oxford as well, and my master's too, for reasons that I think we'll get onto as the podcast continues. But essentially, I tried to apply to other places, but Oxford was the place that kept calling me back. And so I wrote my thesis on 18th century elocution books and reading manuals and sort of instructions to do with reading. But now I actually don't work in academia at all, and I've just left and started an office job.
That's awesome. So, and your office job is in recruitment?
Yeah, that was kind of what I had wanted to do. I'd really wanted to work in learning and development, in trying to help people think about how they could use their skills in different industries. And that's kind of what I've ended up doing now, being the sort of person that looks over CVs and matches people with their jobs, although I don't actually work for a recruitment firm, but it's very similar.
That's so cool. And so just before we get into like that side of things, because you actually did a lot of work on helping people find their direction and their skills during your PhD, which is pretty incredible, to be honest. But if we just focus on your PhD, like, As you said, you were at Oxford and you did a master's. How did you know you wanted to do a master's and then know you wanted to do a PhD?
I think it was slightly different each time. So I originally wanted to do a master's because I thought, you know, I'm not done with studying. I discovered sort of halfway through my undergrad degree that the stuff I thought I was interested in was not really the stuff that I was interested in. And I thought that I liked really cool, modern literature. And then actually I realised that the stuff I liked about it, I could also find elsewhere. And it really made me rethink my direction. And I thought, oh no, I really want to study the 18th century and I've barely done it at all. And I applied for a couple of courses where you could do that. But then by the time I got to doing that master's, I thought, oh no, I have this very particular project in mind and I don't think this master's course is going to give me the opportunity to do it. I'm going to run out of time. The topic that I'm interested in is just too big to be kind of answered in a master's dissertation. And so I thought about applying for PhDs and I thought, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll get a job. So I started applying for both jobs and PhD places at the same time. Not too many, because I was trying to actually finish the course, which was a bit of a nightmare in itself. And I sort of had to think about whether I'd be willing to take a year out or what I was going to do instead if it didn't work out. But fortunately, I'd heard back about a scholarship in the meantime, so I didn't need to make that choice in the end. Yeah. But I did sort of have a plan B in the background.
Yeah, so it's like interesting that you say that the things you studied at undergrad, I feel like loads of people in any field, when you go in, you think you're going to end up doing one thing. And actually often the things you think you're going to love, maybe it's because of the teaching, maybe it's just because other things are like underdogs that come through that you end up loving. But I think that's common for a lot of people, that you end up completely changing. And I think it's incredible that you were actually basically able to write a proposal. It sounds like, you know, you had this idea of a question you wanted to ask. I think that's really unusual, and maybe not for humanities, but.
Yeah, I think so. I think when I talk to people about this, I'm always very cautious. So, well, actually, I was a bit, I was quite narrow in my focus, and so that was quite helpful because it helped me know what I wanted to do. But actually, it's not unusual to have maybe two or three different, like really different ideas for things that you want to study. And I think picking is the first bit. I think that gets you a long way. But I understand that there's always the, I think it's almost a problem of possibilities, that if in your mind that you could do one thing and that seems equally plausible as submitting a different proposal and doing another thing, then actually picking becomes really difficult. And that said, you don't always have to pick. You can pitch different proposals to different universities and work through it that way. But the problem is it often requires a lot of hefty brain work to make sure that all of these things feel equally plausible and feel right, as though they're all things that you equally want to do.
Yeah, like when you're applying, that every person when you see, like they get that 100% enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I've always wanted to do. And then you have to go to the other interview and say that too. And it's just like, yeah,
exactly. And I mean, that is what people do. And I can remember doing it myself and going, yes, this is absolutely the thing that I want to do. And this is the only place at which I can do it. And of course, that's not always true.
But in terms of the place, like you said, you were going to talk about how you ended up, like you've done like a long time at Oxford, like, which is quite, you know, I wasn't here for my undergrad, but it's quite an intense place to study. Yeah. Had you wanted to try something different, or like, can you talk us through that, how that turned out for you staying?
Yeah, I mean, on a very basic level, it was finances that kept me at Oxford. When I was an undergrad, Oxford had the best bursary and grant package available to me at the time. So that made the most financial sense. It was the only place that offered me a master's scholarship. So that, again, took the choice, not away from me, but made the choice very easy, I think. And the same thing happened when I applied for PhDs. I got into a couple of London universities and they didn't offer me funding. And at the time, for me, that was the same as a rejection. I couldn't, it was really gratifying to be told, actually, yeah, we think this is a great project and you should definitely be allowed to do it, but we're not going to pay your fees or your living costs. And I was like, well, I don't have any money in the background that's going to help me with this. As soon as my student loan runs out, that's it, I'm out of cash. And that, I think, for me was the big driver. And it's certainly something that I always tell people to bear in mind when they are applying for either university or graduate school generally, is thinking about, like, how are you going to pay for this? Because it is a big financial commitment or financial decision. Even as somebody that's been privileged enough to be fully funded more or less throughout, there have been things that have suddenly sprung up that I haven't really thought about. So, for example, all the time I've been studying, my original student loan has been racking up interest, even, and I've not been paying it off because I haven't been working in that way.
Yeah.
And so there's stuff like that to think about, that in a way that I hadn't before. Or I suppose, to sound slightly more grown up and boring, there are friends of mine who left university or didn't go at all, who have been paying into pension plans for years, you know. They've already saved for retirement. I'm like, oh, I've never had to think about this in this way. And it's just interesting to think about it in that way. I'm glad that so far it hasn't impacted my choices too much, and that I've still been able to do a lot of the things that I wanted to do. But at the same time, I haven't had that kind of flexibility. So people say, oh, you must really like Oxford. And I mean, I do. And I love it as a city. As well, but part of the reason for it is because it was the financially sensible choice at all given points.
Yeah, I think that's like such an important point, especially for the humanities. And I'm not a humanities student. I'm essentially a biomedical scientist at PhD, but I've, you know, talked to people who are either on a master's, and it just sounds really, it sounds like a demoralizing process in a way, because whilst I think STEM can be really creative in ways people don't anticipate, the humanities is such a creative kind of giant faculty of different sub-humanities. And I can't imagine what it would be like to put forward a proposal that's quite close to your heart, or maybe to do with a literature that you're really passionate about. And then somebody says, this is great, but we're not going to pay you to do this. And I'm sure you can testify to this, Ellen, like a PhD is hard work. So I think it's pretty outrageous, to be honest, that people aren't given a stipend at least to live on, because the hours you put in, I mean, even with funding, I dread to think how that works out. Like I try not to think, and I know it's a training exercise and it is a privilege, but it must be demoralizing for people when they don't get that funding, or when funding's a really limiting factor.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I think it is a real shame that people aren't paid for their labour, or that we as academics are often supposedly set on a career path where actually the progression isn't always great or secure, whether financially or in terms of sort of location and job contracts. I think the pandemic's really revealed that as well. I think it was always there in people further up the sort of academic line can definitely attest to this. But you can really see how tenuous the funding is, particularly in the arts and humanities. I mean, this isn't news, but I think it's definitely something to think about. The conditions under which you as an individual are happy to undertake your project. And, you know, I think for me, that was definitely, you know, I get paid to do this. I have enough money to have a roof over my head in conditions that, you know, don't make me unhappy, essentially, you know, that I get to live with people that I've chosen or in a house share. And, you know, I come at this as somebody that doesn't have particularly complicated circumstances. I might not necessarily have a lot of money behind me, but, you know, I don't have kids or a disability or other factors which might make participating in university life a lot more difficult. Yeah. And so for me, it was a bit more of an easy choice because I didn't have these other factors to take into account.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. And that's because I'm in a position where I don't have to, fortunately. But you're so right. I mean, I think they're trying to make graduate study more kind of accessible, I guess is the word. And I think, I don't know about you, but from my experience, I'm at St. Evan Hall. You do see more diversity, I think, at the graduate level, people from all walks of life, people who've gone and worked for a while coming into graduate study. And yeah, it must be, it's a huge thing to consider, which kind of takes me into, we had quite a few questions about what is your advice for people considering PhD or master's. So one question was going straight in versus taking a break. And then another question, which I think is so common, which you've kind of already answered a little bit, but is a master's the right thing for somebody to do at the end of a bachelor's, or is it procrastinating with real life?
What a great way of phrasing it. I'm probably not the best person to ask about taking a break. I think in part because, well, I never did it and I never really considered doing it. For me, it would always have been the second choice. It would have been because, you know, I didn't get the funding that I wanted or needed. But then at the same time, thinking about it and having met a lot of people, for a lot of people, taking the time out is really important and really necessary. I think particularly when thinking about PhD proposals, thinking about what you want to do, pitching that project, actually having the time to think about it, being able to apply with a grade in hand can make a real difference, because I found it really difficult to make a speculative application. Essentially my PhD proposal was, so I'm going to write this master's dissertation and it's going to be about this one man and his theories in the 18th century, but actually there were loads of these kinds of theories, and so I want that to be the PhD, but I haven't really written about it yet, so I can't tell you any more than that. And it's a slightly bizarre exercise, whereas I know people that took the year out had written a lot of the foundational work or decided that they wanted to do something different, and they just had the time to think about it. And I think that makes for a better proposal a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need a break from uni as well, to be honest. I think, you know, if you've got the chance to travel a bit or to work and just exist in slightly different circumstances, I think it can make a real difference. A lot of people who have sort of intended to go back have decided, well, actually, no, this is not something I'm keen to pursue after all. And I think it's completely legit to change your mind as well. But then I also know people that have worked in industries like publishing for, you know, like a decade, and then they come back in and they do a master's and a PhD, and they have a completely different career and life outlook after that. And I think it's all very much down to personal circumstances, really. I think I don't regret going straight through, but also now having gone through the process of leaving, I'm like, yeah, I think now was a good point for me.
Yeah, exactly. I do think it is personal. I was the same as you. I didn't take a break. I think I was a bit scared if I got off the train, I would never get back on, to be honest.
Yeah.
Which is a weird way to think, actually, looking back. But it was definitely my decision. I think it was impressed upon me at the interview stages for a PhD. Not so much master's, I'll admit, because it is just the 1 year. But PhD, they were asking me a lot of questions about, are you sure about this? And I think at that point, if I didn't want it, I would have probably stepped away.
I think that's a good question to be asked. Yeah. It's really interesting to think that a lot of the time people don't ask you that, which is, are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah.
And I think it's still a relevant question even for older people. I say older people, we're not particularly old. but what I mean is, you know, we often talk about, you know, kids at school doing A-levels, being pressured into doing uni courses that they don't really want to do because of parental pressure or social pressure, you know, that they should maybe be thinking about other routes into industry or work or into finding the things that they want to do with their lives. But I think it's interesting that we almost stop asking adults the same thing. You know, are you doing this because you just feel it's the next step? You know, I've done a master's, therefore, you know, I must do a PhD. And I think it can be worth just taking the time to think about it. And I'm kind of glad that, you know, when you're applying for things, people have said, you know, is this is what it will be like? Is this something that you'd like to do? And, you know, I think that shouldn't be a question that people kind of shy away from. Of course, the problem with it is if you decide that it's something you don't want to do, you have to think of something else, and that's the absolute worst.
Yeah, and hopefully that moment of crystallization isn't in front of that person, you know, because then you're just thinking, what do I say? But then that question serves a purpose then, if you do change your mind. And I really wanted to just draw upon this point. We actually had a question, and you put it perfectly, Ellen, about parental pressure. Three questions came through on this. Basically, the questions were, how do I tell my parents I've changed my mind during my degree? They didn't say whether they were undergrad or postgrad. I'd guess undergrad, because, you know, you tend to look at your parents for approval a bit more when you're younger, I guess. How do you tell them you've changed your mind? And if your parents aren't supportive of your dreams, becoming financially independent, could you sort of discuss what your thoughts are on that a little bit?
Yeah, I really feel for people in that situation. I think in part because it's not something I've necessarily experienced myself, in part because, so I sort of mentioned that I didn't necessarily have the financial backing to undertake further study without sort of institutional help. And that wasn't because my parents weren't supportive, it was just that they didn't have any money. Yeah. And so therefore I didn't have any money. And ironically, I feel that in some ways that has meant that my choices and the things that I have chosen to apply for, the opportunities I've chosen to chase, haven't been driven by that parental input because they have no financial stake in it, like whatsoever.
Right.
My parents are always like, well, you know, Ellen, if that's what you want to do, if it makes you happy, then that's great. If you can keep a roof over your head while you're doing it, even better. Great. And so I think it can be really hard, particularly when you're getting to the point where, you know, you don't live at home, you don't necessarily see your parents or talk to them on a day-to-day about, you know, your thinking or essentially where you're at, whether that's like with your career or relationships or anything really. And sometimes it can then suddenly feel as though you've made this realization in yourself, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, or I want to do something else.
Yeah.
And then suddenly that feels like a big announcement rather than what it probably was for you as an experience, which is from day to day, learning a bit more about yourself and what kind of things you like to do, and therefore kind of making an announcement about it. You know, it's that switch between, you know, talking about something a little bit every day, and then suddenly, you know, going home after 6 weeks and going, oh my God, I've had an epiphany, which, you know, you might have, you might not. I think you put it as like crystallizing this idea.
So
I guess to bring it back to the question, I think it is about being honest. And I think it might depend on what the switch you're making or you're thinking about making is, because I can really see that for some people, you know, I don't know, making a switch from, you know, studying French language to, I don't know, history or something else is for a lot of people much of a muchness. And it will also depend on your parents' attitude towards the finances in that way. So for example, if your parents are paying for your degree and they've said, well, you know, we agreed to pay for you to do a law degree, not for you to do, you know, X, Y, Z. Those are then conversations that it's really difficult to have.
Yeah.
I think my main advice is to go into it thinking, well, a lot of the time, you know, your parents like really well, and they're probably out to support you. And that if you can be brave enough to be open with them about why you've changed your mind, that can really help, particularly if you have the beginnings of a plan. Right? It doesn't have to be a sort of extensive 10-year plan. But, you know, if you're like, well, actually, I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to work in publishing. And, you know, I've been looking at internships or all the other kinds of things that I can do to try and make that happen. I think if you feel that need to prove that you're making the right decision or justify it to somebody, your parents, anybody else, that can be really helpful, I think, in that way, in helping them understand that this isn't just something that you're feeling whimsical about. You know, you've had a bad day and you're like, actually, I don't want to do this after all, you know, very overdramatic, in a way that I think maybe sometimes adults, parents can sometimes accuse us of being, when actually that's not the truth.
Yeah.
But I mean, I say this as somebody that hasn't always been honest with my parents about this. For years I was like, oh, it's fine, Mum, because you know, I can study English literature. My mum's Asian, from the Philippines, and so, you know, it's kind of doctor, lawyer, accountant, that's kind of it. And I was like, oh, but you know, you can do English literature and then you can transfer into law, and it just never happened. But I think she got the idea eventually, so I feel you can also hint. Yeah, you don't have to be so direct about it, but
yeah
I think that can, I don't know, it's really hard to navigate. I think being honest about what you want to do can be really helpful. Demonstrating that you're already doing it can also really help.
Like a contingency plan, do you mean, sort of?
Yeah, or just kind of showing people that, you know, this isn't actually an implausible thing for you to do. I think quite often a lot of the clashes that happen between parents and children often come because your parents have a very fixed idea of who you are based on who you were when you were younger, and that when you sort of present them with perhaps evidence to the contrary or a suggestion that it's different now because, you know, you've grown or you've had time to live by yourself or out of their household, that can actually be a real source of tension. I mean, it's like whenever I go back home and my mum thinks that I don't like food that I didn't like when I was five. And I'm like, but you know, I'm not five. I can happily eat a wider range of foods now, please. But yeah, it's that idea of, oh, but didn't you say you wanted to do this? I don't mean it in a bad way. It is literally just, you know, you said you wanted to do this when you were 17. And I think gently reminding them, you know, well, I'm slightly older now and I've had all these different experiences that have shown me that I actually want to do this instead, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, also to some extent, that's fine, I'm doing it. You know, I think that's also allowed.
Yeah, and that's something I was going to say is, and this could be controversial, depending on the relationship you have with your parents. So I Well, with my mum, for instance, I think, and with my, like, you know, stepmom and like other members of the family, I'm quite an emotional person, and I think I tend to be quite transparent. So they sort of know how I'm feeling. But if you're the kind of person who feels like this is going to be a big announcement, I would recommend you do not do what I did, which is tell them every second thought that comes into your head, because then you do come across a little bit fickle. And I think if you're really serious about something and you're wanting to do a different career, or, you know, potentially withdrawing from a degree, I just think, I'm sure people have already done this, but take a bit of time to be as sure as you can be that that's what you want. And then, because the worst thing is if you keep changing the narrative, I think parents can find that anxiety driving, and even if they're parents, they still face anxiety like we do. And I think they need like clear messages. And something I'd also say is, as somebody who whose parents like have never been to somewhere like Oxford, and no offense, don't really understand what it's like to do a PhD, I think for them, they're very much on the outside. And so they, as much as we try and get them to understand what it feels like to be in this high pressurized environment, they're doing their best, but they can't fully understand. So I think mixed messaging could be confusing. So my advice would be to just have a think, maybe consult with a member of staff or like some, like a tutor, and then you can go to your parents with a potential vague idea of a backup plan. So it's not, so that there's some sort of linearity to what you're saying. I don't know I think I should say at this point that Ellen actually has quite a lot of experience with this, because we never mentioned it, but Ellen worked as a career graduate teaching and careers officer for the English department. So I just wanted to put that in there. But
yeah, definitely. I think you're right, Kate. It's that sometimes parents, but I mean also just for your own peace of mind, thinking about how you've changed your mind and then how you're going to move on from that can then make a real difference. And particularly in terms of how it's received, it's kind of like applying for jobs, right? In that you want to create this sense of a narrative where obviously this is the next logical step, and actually because you've spent so much time in your head thinking about it, to you this seems like the right thing to do, and so you should go ahead and do it. But from the point of view of a listener, say like a parent, you know, you might have gone off to uni, seemed to be having a great time, you know, pre-corona, posting photos on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, you know, having a good time. And then you come back and you're like, actually, there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on as well that I didn't tell you about. And whereas, yeah, trying to keep people updated, or maybe even laying the groundwork in advance, you know, oh, I've just had the opportunity to do X, Y, Z. It's really made a difference in terms of me thinking about what I would like to do after uni, that kind of stuff. Just kind of lay it on thick,
yeah,
and kind of lay the path, perhaps.
Yeah, so it's less of a shock, kind of. Yeah, that was something I was going to say, is I don't know, as we said, what stage this person's in their degree. And I don't know, I mean, obviously when you're in a path that doesn't feel right, it can have massive impacts on your welfare. So if it's an urgent situation, then that's different. But I do know a lot of people who are feeling quite unsure about their degree, because basically this pandemic has changed what a lot of people's degrees look like in terms of structure, yep, socializing, and that university is that. It is a networking as much as it is a training environment. So I was going to ask, like, in your experience, Ellen, what was it like finishing your PhD in a pandemic, and do you have any advice for people who maybe haven't changed their mind, or maybe have, that might be linked to feeling a bit depressed about graduating, especially in these circumstances, and leaving the bubble? Like, do you have any words of comfort or advice from your own experience?
I mean, if me identifying with it and saying, actually, yeah, it was pretty grim, is helpful, then yeah, absolutely. I spent a lot of time writing about my experience of doing a PhD while I was doing it. And quite often people will ask me things like, you know, how do you stay productive, or how do you stay motivated while you're doing this? And a lot of the time I just felt like writing, I am not motivated. I do not feel good about this. There is a big, horrible, scary thing happening in the world right now. And to be honest, my very, very overgrown essay just doesn't feel important right now.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, and as my supervisor was keen to remind me, you know, I had to get it done. I had a time frame in which to get it done. Yeah. Particularly early on in the pandemic, where I was anticipating being finished in 6 months, it increasingly became obvious that the pandemic wasn't going to be over in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, all my opportunities for part-time work have disappeared. All the things that I used to do in person, that meant that I had a bit of extra money, that meant that I could save in case I did need a bit longer to finish when my funding ran out. You know, I was very aware of that time pressure. All the things that I used to do to kind of unwind disappeared. Yeah. You know, I couldn't go out. Even things like, oh, I'm having trouble working, so I'm going to, you know, go to a cafe or find a friend to work with, and we're going to sit in the library and we'll work together and sort of push through. All of that stuff was removed, and you had to find the kind of online alternatives, which was then just me kind of making laboriously sweet drinks and, you know, sitting with someone on Zoom, tapping out the next chapter draft.
Or a neighbor climbing over your wall to... I don't even remember why that... Oh, I locked myself out, so Ellen didn't realise it, but she actually had a very new friend climbing over her back wall, but...
But yeah, exactly. And it was a lot. And then to suddenly find myself thinking, well, actually, I didn't really want to apply for academic jobs.
Yeah.
Or maybe I should apply for academic jobs. And then suddenly thinking, well, which of the two job markets, as I see it, are better? You know, the one where I don't have any or very much experience, where I have to kind of wrangle a narrative out of my graduate school career to try and get me into essentially a career about careers, or do I keep pushing forward with academia, even if the conditions of working, so having lots of part-time jobs, or, you know, working in two or three different universities at once, even if that's something that I don't necessarily want to do. And so I had to really wrestle with that, I think. But
yeah, did you feel, do you think you felt expected or pressured to stay in academia because you'd done a PhD?
Partly, I think it happens a lot. It wasn't necessarily something that was really a concerted effort, but you'd often talk to people and they would have conversations with you about careers or jobs in a way that assumed that because you were doing a PhD, you wanted to be an academic. Yeah. And this happens in lots of scenarios. I mean, it even happened in my Viva, where they were like, oh, so, you know, what's going to happen with this now? You know, here are all the things you could do. And we discussed it as a kind of hypothetical. But at no point had they asked me, you know, what do you intend to do?
Yeah.
And so towards the end, I sort of felt the need to confess. And I was like, oh, well, actually, by the way, I've just signed a job offer. So I'm actually going to be doing something completely different. Apologies. So even though it was like really flattering to have your work talked about in this really professional way, I was like, I'm sorry. This is not what I want to do after all. Or even like really well-meaning people, tutors and things, sending me job application forms, or saying, oh, look, there's this great job in Iceland or Norway, which was then, it felt at the time to me very much at odds with how I felt about it.
Right.
I was very fortunate that my supervisor at the very beginning said, you know, after this, do you know what you want to do? Because that will shape how, you know, I will seek to guide your career, essentially. And I said, well, I don't really know. So I would like to, you know, give academia my best shot. So I'd like to do, you know, the things that you're meant to do and go to conferences and apply for grants and do all of that. And I did end up doing a lot of that stuff. But she was also really encouraging of me. So like applying for the teaching and careers job, because that was something that I'd wanted to do, and just sort of pursuing my own interests as well, even outside the PhD, which is obviously designed for you to pursue your interests as well.
Yeah.
But I think the thing with committing to a three-year project is that you don't always have the scope for dealing with it if those interests change. So while I was very invested in the process of doing a PhD, sort of when that came to the end, I was like, oh, I've got this thesis now, but I don't really want to, you know, turn it into something else or a book. Sort of run out of steam, I guess, almost.
Yeah, or like I've heard people use a phrase like phrase it kind of ran its course, like it reached its natural conclusion. And if you are feeling down about leaving the graduate bubble, because I think it is a bit of a bubble, it's quite a safe environment. We're mingling with people of similar kind of, I guess, liberalish values. Like we do have that. And I think when you're leaving, if you don't want to stay in academia, this is what this person told me, don't force it. It's better in a way to sort of accept that it's coming to an end. And it's horrible for finalists this year who are not having the experience they felt they were promised. I've not been through that because I'm not done yet. But like, I don't think, in answer to the master's question that came earlier, I don't think that's a reason to stay. And I think in a way, holding on to the dream, to the nostalgia, might actually be more depressing. So I think in a way you do yourself more of a service to sort of be like, this was one stage in my life. I'm going to the next stage and I'm going to go in both feet forward or with a good foot forward. That was what this advisor basically said anyway, because I don't think I'm staying in academia. So that was their advice to me, was just like, that's okay. Just accept it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because it can be really hard to almost let go, can't it? Or feel that... I don't know, I've spoken to a lot of people about sort of success and what success in academia looks like. Mm. And a lot of people, I think, sort of anecdotally have this fear that if you do a PhD but you don't stay, it's never a choice. It's always because you've almost been ground down and you've been forced to do something else. Yeah. And that's a narrative that I'm really not happy with. At all. I don't think it applies to me. I don't think it applies to a lot of my friends who have chosen to do different things. The whole point of pursuing education, at least for me, and in terms of how my parents often put it forward to me, was that, you know, education gives you choice. It gives you the power of choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, why is it that almost the more educated you are, the less choice you feel you have? And I think a lot of that is a mindset thing, you know. You can really begin to think about what else you could see yourself doing, or what things in your life do you enjoy? And a lot of those things are, for me at least, PhD related. You know, I really enjoyed talking to people about their career paths. I loved teaching and working with people on a small group or one-to-one basis. You know, I didn't enjoy giving lectures or talks, and that began to tell me the kinds of things that I did like doing. And so I started thinking about what kind of jobs might be out there for me, to enable me to continue doing the things that I enjoyed and kind of move slightly past some of the things I didn't. I mean, obviously there's stuff about my new job that I'm like, oh, great, admin, love admin. No, but you know what I mean? It's sort of, I feel like I've chosen something that's a little bit more suited to my temperament, perhaps.
Yeah.
I don't know if you feel this, Kate, where it can be difficult when you have lots of options open to you as well.
Yeah.
Obviously ones that are suggested from your like career choice and history and, you know, things that you're interested in or your past experience. But also just, you know, I'm a competent person, I could do lots of things. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I agree. It's both empowering and then depends how decisive you are as a person. And yes, I actually completely agree. And it's something that I realised, well, I spoke to the career service at Oxford, which I don't know what you think, Ellen, but I think they're fantastic. I think they're wonderful people who've all come from very, you know, different walks of life with lots of experience. So anyone listening to this, recommend you talk to them. But in answering your question, it is hard when it sounds a little arrogant, but I'm going to say it anyway, when you're competent and you have abilities and you have skills, especially if you're somebody who's done a little bit of everything. So me doing science and podcast or whatever, and you know, you did English, but you also were really interested in engagement and outreach and helping students. And I think it does present with lots of options. And I also had to stop asking other people for advice, which is a bit ironic given the content of this podcast, but it's so hard when you're listening to background noise all the time. And then it was my mum who just said, you know, it's your life and you probably do have an inner voice that's giving you some kind of like a compass, basically, which is the whole point of this episode, that's saying this doesn't feel quite right, this kind of feels right. But we're so focused and conditioned to listen to what other people think, especially as women. we're so conditioned to be passive and always asking our approval, what other people think, it can be really hard to just be bold and brave enough to listen to your own voice, even if that's like, you know, you've done 4 years of this PhD, but actually academia is not for you and that's not a failure. So I completely agree with you. Having lots of options can be super, it's a privilege, but it's also really overwhelming. And I think it's important to listen to your voice.
Yeah, definitely. I think because there is so much discourse out there about sort of academia as a thing, I think it's really interesting to me that academia as a kind of inverted commas industry has it so that there are jobs in academia and then there are alt-ac jobs, or that there are non-academic jobs, you know, whereas if I work, I don't know, if I worked in a different office to the one that I work in, you know, and then I worked somewhere else, they wouldn't say, oh, well, she's, you know, got a job in a different industry, she's now dead to us. It's not seen in that way in the rest of the world. Yeah. I think it's really interesting that as academics, you often end up feeling that's almost what you're doing, which isn't really. I mean, if, you know, a friend of mine in a job said, oh, I no longer like my job, or I've seen a better job or a different job that I would prefer to do, you know, it pays better, or it's closer to my home, you know, myriad of reasons why you might want to apply for something. Everyone would say, oh, that's brilliant, that's great. And rightly so. But when you're contemplating that in academia, sometimes people say things like, oh, are you sure, you know, you could apply for these myriad opportunities, which don't pay as well, or don't, aren't conducive to you living in one place or with your partner, which don't necessarily meet the needs of your outside life. And I think that's...
There's like a bit of snobbery.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
This notion you should be pursuing something noble and like the pursuit of knowledge. And it's like, well, knowledge doesn't pay the bills, hon. And also like...
No, exactly.
Or fulfilling. People are different.
Yeah, or I think I saw a great Instagram post recently, genuinely inspiring, honest, which said, work won't love you back.
Yeah.
And that really, I think that really caught me at the time. I think I'd just finished, you know, I was waiting for a job contract to come through, and it really hit me, because I think quite often we do have this discourse of, you know, work should be a vocation. You should, you know, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life, you know, that kind of stuff. But the problem with that is, when do you stop working? If work is your life, what do you have outside of that? And for some people, it really works, you know, academia is their life and they can do it. But I can remember, particularly towards the end, I think, feeling as though I was faking the enthusiasm. I really, because I loved my project. I loved doing it. I loved the process of it. But I just couldn't feign enthusiasm for, you know, applying to do something else. And you're right. I think it had come for me, at least, to a natural stop. If I'd had a different project in mind that made me just as excited as my PhD had, then yeah, sure, go for it. You know. But I didn't, and I think that was okay. I read job descriptions, and looking at academic ones, I was like, oh no, all this, you know, all this teaching, all this lecturing doesn't really appeal to me. Whereas I'd read other job descriptions, I'd be like, yes, that sounds like me. I could do that. And I think that can be really helpful as well, just seeing what's out there, becoming more familiar with it. Because I'd become very familiar with how to navigate the academic job landscape, and that felt comfortable.
Yes.
And applying for sort of different jobs, non-academic jobs, was suddenly really scary. And I was like, I didn't even have a non-academic CV. I hadn't needed one.
Yeah, I think we've basically said extensively that probably neither of us intend to stay in academia. And I think it's actually good, anyone listening to this, that you're hearing two people say that, because it's not talked about. You always hear about the people who stay.
Well, it's because they're there to talk to you, right?
Exactly. It's a bit of an echo chamber. I wanted to ask you a question someone got us, which is kind of sort of, you know, linked to what we were just talking about. Obviously, this is produced in collaboration with OxfemSoc, so we had quite a lot of questions about women in the workplace, both in academia and in the non-academic workplace. And I was going to ask, in your experience as a PhD slash as someone who is applying for jobs slash someone who's now helping other people find their calling path, have you become of obstacles facing women or, I guess, other marginalized groups or inequalities, like through your work or experience?
Yeah, I think quite often the barriers to entry, particularly the barriers to women or to people of colour or to disabled people, are often about the ways in which career paths are constructed or the ways in which job applications are set up. So, for example, things like we know now that we navigate in a kind of digital job market where you know, you have to use things like computers to upload a CV, to fill out forms. It's not necessarily the traditional way of getting a job that people often think about, particularly parents or grandparents, where they say things like, you know, why don't you just print out your CV and go walk around town, get a job that way. And you're like, that's not how getting a job works now so much. And actually things like that can cause massive barriers either to getting into an industry or progressing within a career field, because there are things like, I don't know, say you're a parent or you have a chronic illness, and so your working patterns vary from the standard 9-to-5 or your desired working patterns. I think the pandemic has really shown employers, though, the possibilities that are out there for more flexible forms of working.
Yeah.
Particularly with like working from home or using flexi time, working compressed hours. That was the thing I discovered while doing a job search. But also having people more open to working part-time or in job shares.
Right.
Something that's increasingly common now. So yeah, I find that there are lots of barriers out there to finding work or existing in the workplace. Mm. They are often about that. In the course of my own job search, I have been pleased, though, to see that there are lots of employers out there who are really aware of this and are aware of the need for either reasonable adjustments or for flexible ways of working.
Yeah.
You know, if you're results driven, if the work still gets done, you know, does it matter so much if, you know, I work slightly odd hours or if I can only work during school hours, things like that. I think there are definite ways of working around that. But again, it's about seeing what's out there and seeing who is welcoming to that kind of approach. Because unfortunate as it is, a lot of employers aren't. But then there are also an awful lot that are. And so I think that makes a real difference.
Yeah, and we were saying, I think that's actually a really nice sentiment, like quite hopeful. I just wanted to say that. And we were talking just shortly before the podcast about any resources you might be aware of for women, non-binary individuals, people of colour listening to this, where they can, I guess, get recruitment advice that takes into account things they might be worried about to do with work culture, you know, things we were just talking about.
Yeah, definitely. I think talking to a recruiter can really help if you're aware of the industry that you want to work in. Chatting to recruiters so that they get a sense of, you know, who you are, how you identify, and the kinds of workplaces that you'd be happy to work in. That can be really, really useful and helpful. There are particular organisations as well that can help people. So, for example, I've used a site before called Creative Access, which looks at providing opportunities for people of colour in the creative industries where we're massively underrepresented. And they advertise a lot of things like internships in galleries or working on TV documentaries as researchers, those kind of creative jobs. In a way, trying to list the opportunities in one place. That can be really helpful. They're not necessarily ring-fenced for certain people, but at the same time, it can be really helpful to find resources or tips of how to navigate the job market, depending on who you are. And I think for me, one thing to bear in mind, particularly when you're very early on in your job search, is to remember that if you do get a job interview, it's not just about them seeing whether you would be good at the job and whether they want to hire you. It's also a chance for you to see if the workplace would be welcoming to you. And obviously that's a massively privileged thing to be able to say, oh, well, you know, you don't necessarily have to take this job. And for a lot of people, that realistically isn't an option right now. And I do understand that. But at the same time, being able to take the time and consider, you know, does this workplace have similar values to me? Is it welcoming to people like me? I think is really important. I think that your labour and your talent is really powerful and can really make a difference to an organisation, and you're perfectly within your rights to withhold it from them as well. And I think that's also something to think about. I have been to job interviews where, you know, I have a very English name and they've been very surprised, openly surprised to see that I'm not white. And that has really soured me against companies and working for individuals in that way. And so I have been glad to exist in places that, you know, have a very open policy about equality and diversity, that take the time to train their employees about these issues, that explicitly say, you know, just because you're not in a minority doesn't mean that this doesn't affect you or the people that you work with, and that silence is complicity and that you have a duty to speak up, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, on the one hand, very laborious going through it, you know, on training days and PowerPoints, but at the same time, really meaningful and important to do.
Yeah. This is like really similar to a question someone asked us, which, like you said, it's meaningful because clearly there's an issue, because there's somebody who's responded to this, that we basically put out a call for questions, who is an undergrad, and they asked us this question, which is basically everything Ellen's talking about. And they said, I'm just reading it, I want to read it as it verbatim, not wanting to fetishize being a person of color, but still wanting equal opportunities and not trusting you'll get them if you don't play the card. So I guess that's somewhat similar to what you're, I don't know if you want to speak on that, Ellen.
Yeah, definitely. I have definitely been aware of this while applying for numerous jobs, in that quite often you fill out an application, and then there might be a thing at the end where they ask you to do an evaluation of the recruitment process, and they might ask you questions about yourself, like where you're from, your economic background, your skin colour or religious or ethnic identity, you know, things like that, depending on the role. I think whether you put these things down is a matter of personal choice. As I've already mentioned, on paper, I often read as a white person. To those of you listening, you perhaps haven't necessarily seen my face. You might think that I sound like a white person, you know, whatever that means. And I think I've spoken to a lot of my friends who, often like me, are mixed race, about the privilege that proximity to whiteness, particularly proximity to whiteness when doing paperwork, can give you. So I think for me, it's always been important to fill out those forms and almost declare these aspects of myself. But you might not necessarily feel the same way. Although I would say, and I think I would say this to everyone, that if there is an opportunity out there and you meet the requirements for it and you want to do it, you should absolutely go for it. Don't close yourself from things because you're worried about accusations of, you know, well, you only got this because you identify as XYZ or because you're part of this minority, because that doesn't solve the problem of people like us being underrepresented. And I think hopefully one day we can move beyond that thinking. But for the time being, I don't think you should close yourself to opportunity. But I think that's how I would approach it. It will depend, though, on like the nature of the opportunity as well.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you might be eligible for something and you think, well, actually, maybe this isn't for me. Because, yeah, I think I had this when applying for things that were sort of designed for people from working class backgrounds, which like, includes me, like my 7 years at Oxford voice aside. But sort of in my head, I was like, is this really for me now at this point? You know, at what point does my privilege at being educated in this way kind of offset that in some way? Sometimes it feels like it has, and sometimes it really feels like it hasn't. And that can be really hard to navigate, even on a day-to-day basis. So I think primarily, I suppose in answer to that question, always have the opportunity at the front of your mind and think about if this is something that you want, then definitely go for it. And there are resources out there for people who, you know, who need to navigate a workplace, which can often be actively hostile to aspects of your identity. And there are people out there who can help you with that. Not necessarily like in your place of work, but ideally, hopefully there too.
Thank you so much for talking on that in particular, Ellen, because that was something we got a couple of questions about. I get the sense it's something people feel awkward talking about, and I hope it's something people feel less awkward talking about, hearing somebody like you discussing it. And I can't really add anything to, I don't want to add anything to what Ellen said, apart from just don't, whoever wrote that question, please just don't limit yourself, because you sound like a great person. So I hope that whatever it is, whatever industry you want to get into, that you, like Ellen said, keep the opportunity at the front of your mind, because it would be a shame if we didn't get your talent, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, people from the outside are always going to say things, I think is the thing. So quite often I've had people on the internet tell me things like, oh, well, you know, you're a privileged Oxbridgey person. So, you know, obviously what you say on this doesn't have any real meaning or feeling or weighting because you haven't experienced it. And I'm like, well, just because I come across a certain way doesn't mean that, you know about me or my life. And people will do that in either positive or negative ways, or they'll say things like, oh, well, you know, you only got this because you're X, Y, Z, not because you earned it. And it's like, well, you know, what do you know?
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's F all, really. And I think you should definitely bear that in mind. You know, if an interview panel says that they're willing to let you do a thing because you apply to do the thing and you have the qualifications for the thing, you know, go do the thing. I hope you enjoy it. You know, what else is there?
Yeah. I think that's great advice. And what you were saying about online, Ellen, obviously everyone comes across a bit different online, because we've all heard we curate things, basically. But I do think at the moment, and this was a question we got, how can people develop their online presence, and what's the importance of this in a candidate portfolio, because of the time we're living in, especially? And what advice would you have? Because obviously you have an incredibly successful Instagram account, so as an expert, fill us in.
I actually went to a workshop about this that was run by the Oxford Careers Service, which was about your online persona. But essentially, I'll pass this information on, so you don't have to go, was that you should just Google yourself and see what comes up. And quite often, you might have a name similar to other people, or one that's not unusual, or you might be the sort of person that has a fairly unique sort of first name and surname combo. But in doing this, you can see what it looks like to an outsider when they look you up. You know, is one of the first things that comes up, say, I don't know, a faculty page or a university page or articles that you've written for a student newspaper. It might be I don't know, your LinkedIn or your blog, that kind of stuff. And it's about making sure that the things that are up there that are within your control are things that you've chosen, and that at a given time really, I guess, put forward the image of you that you would like. So for some academics, that's like having an academic website where, you know, you talk about the articles you've written and the conferences that you've been to. Or it might be an academia.edu profile, you know, that kind of thing. I think from from the slightly different perspective of somebody that also, you know, put out a lot of content, sort of blogging my experiences of doing a PhD while I was doing it, I think consistency is key. People really value being able to see that you've taken the time consistently to generate content. I generally hate that phrase, it sounds quite mechanical, but I mean, to be honest, sometimes it often was, and I was like, to be honest, I'm just doing the same thing I did yesterday, which was reading a book and taking notes. It's taken me longer, far longer than I would like to admit. But you know, being able to do that, I think was quite valuable, at least in giving people a sense of, you know, this is what the day-to-day life is like, in a curated sense, but also trying to be kind of open about that. So I think depending on the needs that your online profile has, you know, are you a business? Are you selling a product? What kind of value does the stuff that you're putting up there kind of add? If it is just a case of you need people to be able to look you up and see what it is you're about, then, you know, does your website do that? Asking somebody else to Google you can actually really help. So in this workshop that I was talking about, I got sat next to this guy. It was before Corona, obviously. And we Googled each other. And then he just had to describe what I was like based on my internet persona. And I had to tell him what I could gather from his.
That's really tricky.
Yeah, it was really fun. I was sort of saying, well, you know, you're clearly a guy that likes to travel a lot. I think you worked in business. I was like, and you've got this website, and this is what it says that you do. And we essentially realized that some of the stuff that was out there about us was just a little bit out of date.
Right.
That sometimes you've got to update it and to keep it relevant. There have definitely been points where I've been like, I'm sick of social media, I want to delete it all. But, you know, at the same time, thinking about the value that it had for me in terms of being able to talk to people about the process of doing a PhD, of talking to people that were further along, or, you know, just starting out on their academic journeys, that was really, really valuable to me.
One thing I would not recommend is I have blended both an academic and personal Twitter, and it's very confusing for the professors who, the like three professors who follow, because I'll tweet cat related political stuff and then there'll be science related stuff, and I kind of wish I'd kept those separate. That's the only thing I would say for professional purposes. And the other thing I would say is I just think if you're online and you have social media, or even if it's not social media, even if it's like a blog or a website, it's a good sign, because people want you to be, I don't know what the phrase, the actual name for it is, but techno-literate. That's what my mum calls it. But if you are like that, then businesses will think, oh, okay, we're working in a pandemic, people are working from home, computers are increasingly important, online communications. I just think it's great if you've got anything, and if you can make that kind of shine, I think that's, I think we undervalue, because we all use social media, we don't realize for older employers it's actually a real draw.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was something that I didn't add to my CV until the very last minute, whereas actually saying, oh yeah, you know, I do know how to use MS Teams, or I do know how to use Zoom or Skype, you know, whatever, or I'm very quick at working out how to use these things even if I haven't used them before. So important. It isn't always an obvious thing to put down, particularly if you like haven't done a course on it, for example. But then I started my new job, and the first thing they did was teach us how to use Teams. And for me, I was sat there going, oh, you know, Teams. Like, I know how to do this. Like, I did my Viva on Teams, you know, I'm definitely up with it. But, you know, for a lot of people, that just wasn't the case. And I think I took my own kind of technological literacy for granted, in a way that I shouldn't have, and certainly you shouldn't, or, you know, anyone that's applying for jobs or looking for opportunities, explicitly saying it, even though it's sort of implicit in, you know, how you do the job application, it's definitely worth emphasizing for sure.
Just like super quick question, because I don't want to take up any more of your time, Ellen, because I've taken quite a bit, but what, as a parting gift, what advice would you have for people specifically entering the job market at the moment who might be feeling a bit uncertain or not sure how to follow their dreams?
I think the main thing is to is to be aware that you do still have choice, and that's something that, you know, education and experience will have given you, that you do have skills, and that it's just about presenting them in a way that puts forward a convincing narrative about yourself. I think it can be so easy to get sucked up into sort of doom scrolling about jobs and unemployment. You know, the applications for Universal Credit are sky high at the moment, Job Seekers Allowance, things like that. But also being aware of, you know, the skills that you have and the things that you have done in your life that will really make people, employers, value you. But also, I think moving beyond that, that perhaps we shouldn't feel, I know I say this at the end of a podcast entirely about, you know, careers and finding yourself and knowing your direction, that actually, you know, the ways that we value ourselves don't necessarily have to be tied to our careers or to our jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think I do really stand by what I said earlier about, you know, work not necessarily loving you back, to really take the time to think about the things that you do love and try and think about what jobs, what opportunities will begin to give you that.
Yeah.
Because I think that really helped me when I was trying to work out what I wanted to do and when I wasn't sure. And so, you know, throughout my PhD, I did things like appear on podcasts. I directed a historical play based on a manuscript because somebody said, we'd quite like to do it and we think it would be fun. Have you ever directed something? And I went, no, but I will give it a go. I think it's important to know that as people that have lived through a pandemic, we're actually quite resilient in the sense of being people who have adjusted very quickly to our ways of living, our ways of being, being changed massively. I think you should give yourself credit for that. And I think, you know, write it down. Not be afraid to talk about it. It's so hard to talk about yourself. But also, I think once you've got the knack, it suddenly makes things a lot easier. A friend of mine always says, you know, this is the first time in our lives where we'll be applying for jobs having maybe not necessarily had that full-time work experience before.
Right.
And that's one of the hardest things. But once you've moved past that, and you will move past it, it will work out. So just keep saying yes to those opportunities. As long as you're sure that there's something that you actually want to do.
Yeah. I think that's such lovely advice. I feel inspired. I think that's wonderful advice. Yeah, and I agree with Ellen, just your value isn't always, and really isn't entirely linked to your career. So I really hope that this chat has, will hopefully just offer people some comfort and a bit of perspective. Even if it doesn't, you don't listen to this and you feel like jumping for joy, I hope it gives you some perspective and shows you that you have value and value can be appreciated in different ways. So Ellen, for people, we talk about your Instagram, but we never actually gave people a way they can find you. So I think it's at Ellen on the Make altogether.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's yep. ELLEN. So at Ellen on the Make, and I'll put it in the description box for this and the other couple of resources you mentioned, Ellen. But I just wanted to thank you so much for your time, Ellen, because you've given me so much on a Sunday evening. So thank you. And this was a lot of fun.
No, definitely. Thank you for having me. I think you're right. It's often really hard to meet people that have sort of said, oh, actually, this wasn't for me and I've done something else. Because when you're in your industry, regardless of what that is, they're already there, right? And they're still there. And so I think it can be quite reassuring. And it certainly was for me, hearing from people that, you know, either quit their PhD or left immediately after doing it because they wanted to do something else. And that's all it is, really. It's just a different thing. And there's no value really ascribed to that. And once you realise that, it's actually kind of liberating, I think. So thanks for having me, Kate.
Thank you to everybody who has listened to this episode, and especially to those of you who contributed your fantastic questions to us, which we discussed during this episode. I hope you guys have a great week and look forward to seeing you in the next episode.